Hello and welcome to the Critical Eye Asia podcast, Inspiring Leaders to Succeed. I'm Holly Carmichael, your host for today, and the Head of Research and Market Development for Critical Eye's APAC division. So these podcasts are part review, but also very much an expansion of a subject matter, engaging on subjects at the forefront of business leaders' minds. Always topical, thought-provoking, and enabling you to learn from leaders at the very top of their game, who have and continue to deliver amazing results. Now, my guest today, Wesley Payne McClendon, is joining us from Australia. So I feel very fortunate to be joined by him and to learn from the perspective of someone in a successful portfolio career. So Wesley is the chair of the board at the Grow Project Foundation and a non-executive director at Vortex Innovations. And among other roles, Wesley is also one of Critical Eye's fantastic global board mentors. So really lovely to have you here with us today, Wesley.
Lovely to be with you, Ali.
Thanks so much, Wes. So today we'll be discussing some of the key themes that have come out of our recent Asia leadership research, including the skills needed in a period of complex change, the role of the HRD, how to influence board dynamics, and then we'll look at the next generation of leaders, as well as diversity, equity, and inclusion. So Wesley, it's such a pleasure to have you join us, and thanks so much. How are you today?
All well in the hood by the beach.
Well, that sounds absolutely delightful, Wesley. I'm pleased to hear it. I think a good place to start would be just to get an overview of your career in a nutshell, and then we'll pick up on some of the themes that are relevant to the workforce and the board.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Holly. I think the three things that I bring to my portfolio, first, as an executive, I've served in managing director roles and heads of practices of three of the four big fours. So at Mercer in London, I was the practice leader and partner for human capital management services, Ernst & Young, head of people advisory services in Melbourne, and also served with PwC in London and Deloitte in the US. But I've also had an extensive career as an academic, as a professor at Edinburgh, and focusing on human capital management, and then consulting, obviously, with my Big Four experience, but also specifically experience as an executive specific to human resources management and people and culture in a number of countries around the world, in the US, UK, Saudi Arabia, Czech Republic, and a number of other places around the world. So I bring all of that to my experience from running businesses to being a part of a leadership team as an academic and thought leader, and obviously as an executive.
That's great, thanks Wes. And some real global expertise for us to draw upon today. So really looking forward to this conversation. I think a good place to start then, Wes, would be to look at skills and the role of the HRD, because I know that throughout the Asia Pac region, it continues to be a challenge to find the right skills in a period of changing customer behaviours and newly emerging business models. I know in our recent research, retaining talent and strengthening leadership capability are considered the two top priorities for senior directors. So really keen to draw more out of that. But I think before we kick off, let's just be mindful of the backdrop that we're operating in at the moment, because I think it's fair to say that uncertainty is becoming the new norm. The view across our global community is that things are likely to get worse before they get better, which means that there will be increased pressure on executives and their teams. But I think inevitably, Wesley, we are at an inflection point, which signals a change really in what is required of leadership. So keen to hear from your perspective, Wesley, what different leadership skills are needed during a period of complex change, would you say?
Yeah, look, it's funny. I think about my mom, who was a Chicago public school teacher for many years, and she talked about teaching to the test that many of her colleagues are doing. So there's typically a standardized state or national test. And so a lot of the teachers were teaching to this test because they believed that it would provide them a good outcome. But the problem was that they were too focused or too narrowly focused. And so even though they may have done well in the test, they weren't given the opportunity to build critical skills, thinking outside the box. and building up capability that would allow them to look at other tests or other circumstances in a much broader light. And so I think the same thing can be said about leadership skills. I think every crisis seems to want to have a specific skill set. And I believe that's probably not the way to look at it because that's probably too narrowly focused. So we need to think broader because as you talked about this new normal, the new normal is, you know, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And so the skill set required needs to cut across all of that, in my mind, as the new business normal. And so there are a number of leadership skills and capabilities that I think are far more transformative. And so the capability that we need to build, again, being as business usual as opposed to specific crisis, because businesses tend to focus, you know, on a crisis of, you know, we aren't able to grow. And so we need someone who has specific leadership skills around growth, or we need to look at other businesses to acquire. So we want to look at people who have specific skills around mergers, acquisitions, and integration and restructure. And again, for me, it's more broad. So we need to think about skills like decision-making. We need to think about skills around objective truth-telling. We need to think about skills around problem mindset, around sharing authenticity, around you know, a number of skills that are cut across these areas as opposed to thinking about this in kind of the vacuum-sealed concept of a crisis. Because again, all of these things are the new business normal. And so the only thing that's going to change is around the speed, probably the stakeholder group, and the impact that all of these things have on a business and obviously leadership as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thanks, Wesley. And I mean, there's some key themes there: volatility, ambiguity, stronger decision making. I'm sure we'll pick back up on those as we go through this conversation. Sure. If we pick up on the stakeholder piece then for the time being, Wesley, because I know one thing that emerged from our research was that improving the quality of strategic debate at the top table remains a real focus for APAC leadership teams. So if we look at the role of the HRD within that as well, what would you say their job is in terms of creating high-performing leadership teams who are able to deliver a strong quality of strategic debate at the top table?
Yeah, look, I think one of the most important things is that we probably have to wear more of a dual hat than only an HR or people and culture hat. So one of the most important things about being able to take a position at the strategic decision-making table is to understand the commerciality of the business. So first and foremost, if you're sitting at that table, it can't just be around people and culture. It has to be the business and the commerciality of that business and the broader performance of that business in the context of using or leveraging people and culture as a way to facilitate that. So that's the way you need to come in. You need to be able to come in with evidence as opposed to thoughts and feelings, so that you can actually measure what it is that you're trying to change or transform, and be outcome focused as opposed to process focused. You need to be able to come in again with that commerciality, understanding how to leverage the differences within a business, but then to be able to put that into some outcome and quantitative value so that people can understand the impact of certain changes, whether that be people or culture or process, but again, with the focus on outcomes.
Okay, that's great. I know being outcome focused, I think, is a really important point to raise, and it is something that I'd like to come on to a little bit later as well, Wesley. Sure. But in terms of the HRD then, how can they ensure themselves that they have a seat at the table? Because I know when we spoke prior to this, that is something which is a real challenge for HRDs right at the moment. So just keen to hear a bit more about that from your perspective.
Yeah, look, I think one of the most important pieces is to be a trusted advisor. So that the advice that you're both providing and listening, which is probably the most important quality of a leader, is to be able to interrogate, peers or CEOs or managing directors by asking questions. And so I think that's where you can listen, evaluate, and provide context. But I think the most important piece to get to that table to to have a place, again, as decisions are made, is to be that trusted advisor. And once again, it's about bringing evidence to the table. I've been in many situations as a consultant where HR and people and culture are providing ideas, but they don't necessarily have a context. They don't have a focus. They don't have commercial value. And so those are the pieces that you have to be able to pull out of your tool bag at any point in time, you know, with data and evidence that suggests that if we do these things, we're going to get, again, these outcomes. And also an understanding of if we don't do these things, what's likely to be the impact as well of doing nothing, if you will.
Okay, that's great. And particularly that point of asking questions. I know when we were last in Singapore for our regional leadership retreat, that was something that came up because I think sometimes it's easy to assume that when you're early in your career, you ask lots of questions, but you should never kind of lose that ability and keenness to learn, really, because whether you're just starting your career or whether you're the chair of a board, I think there's always new things to learn, particularly as the environment constantly changes around us.
Well, one of the things around this idea of asking questions, and as you get later and more mature in your career, mm-hmm. you can actually use asking questions as a way to guide people. So it's not so much about just listening, but in your questions, you can actually provide some guidance. So have you thought about this as opposed to that? Or what if we looked at it from this perspective? What do you think would be the outcome? So you're not only being a trusted advisor and asking questions, you're actually giving the leader the opportunity to develop the solution. And you're helping to facilitate that solution as opposed to just giving the answer. Because nobody wants to hear the answer. What people want to hear is themselves giving the answer. So if you can facilitate that by asking questions, guiding a direction by asking certain questions certain ways, you get to the same point, but they can own it and they'll look at you as helping them get there versus you walking in the room and saying, here's the answer. Leaders don't want to hear the answer. They want to hear themselves think through the process, and you can facilitate that by asking really good and almost guiding questions.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point, Wesley, absolutely. I'm keen to move on and discuss board dynamics in relation to talent, because I think it's quite clear that chairs and CEOs, group CEOs, are putting more pressure on regional presidents and HRDs to have local successors in their pipeline. So with this in mind, how is that changing how boards are looking at talent at the moment?
Yeah, well, one, I think I'm sure it goes along a spectrum, but I think boards are now far more involved. And, you know, I think of them as activist boards. I'm on a number of boards now. And, you know, most of us, we want to be strategic and take a step back. But in all candor, you know, because our names are on the line as directors, we have both a fiduciary responsibility and a strategic responsibility as well. It's important for us to be aware of what's going on. I think one of the ways that HRDs can be a part of that conversation, A, is to be a trusted advisor to the CEO, but you also need to get the mandate from the CEO to be involved in talking through and providing options and ideas that you can talk through. And again, you have to get that mandate or mantle from the CEO to have that conversation with the board. But I think that's a way in which you can get in front of those folks to get that exposure, if you will, to becoming a part of that discussion. It's not often that the HRD of an organization is able to sit at the table in board discussions, unless there's a specific initiative or program of work or something that kind of compels the HRD to have that seat at that table. That's typically a closed loop, if you will. So typically the only people you're going to get from the organization is going to be the CEO, and the CEO has a seat on the board, but HRDs aren't often sitting at that table. I actually, at GrowCon in Australia, I was able to sit at that table on a regular basis. Not only was I part of the board papers, I was able to leverage my relationship with the CEO to have a conversation with the rest of the board about some of the things that we're doing, presented a lot of strategic components, quantified our results, quantified our expectations, and where we were in that kind of journey. So the more, again, evidence and information and ideas and examples around what we were doing and the outcomes that we were trying to get to, the more I was able to be a part of that conversation.
That's great, Wesley. And let's pick up on that theme of exposure as well, because I know when we were in Singapore recently, one key theme that did arise was that the lack of exposure is a real barrier in terms of how to influence boards. So how do you think that executives can overcome these barriers? Have you got kind of any practical advice that you can share to our listener at all?
Yeah, to some degree, I'm going to repeat myself, but it is about how you can develop a good relationship with the CEO or leadership team so that you are almost part and parcel of those conversations. Again, both in terms of commerciality, but how to leverage people and culture as a way to hit some of those performance targets or commercial targets. But you have to be invited, and to be invited, you have to be able to demonstrate evidence of outcomes and performance. And so, you know, typically you're not going to be able to sit at that table just because. There's going to have to be a compelling business case that says West should come to this board meeting, which again is going to probably focus around some very specific initiatives and programs of work. So, like I said, it's unlikely that HRD or other executives, perhaps, you know, finance because of, you know, a RIM committee or a FAIR committee that I chair with the Australian Institute of Architects, the People and Culture Committee. So I'm in charge of recruiting and selecting CEOs, which I'm actually in the process of doing right now. I'm also in charge of running the performance review for the CEO. In charge of succession planning. So there are a number of things that are unique to my role as chair of People and Culture, but as a board member. So the manager within the business rarely gets a part of that conversation, but you know, on a monthly basis, we're able to meet as a People and Culture part of the organization, and he is a part of that conversation as well. So he has direct access to me, but not necessarily a seat at the table in the context of a board meeting.
Okay, that's a great example, Wesley, and very timely that we would be having this discussion then as well. I think that really ties into how regional leaders can positively influence upwards in order to maximize those internal progression opportunities as well.
Yes.
So you, let's pick up on this theme then of progression and development, because I'd love to hear your thoughts, Wesley, around middle management and the next generation of leaders. I know this was something that we spoke about recently at our global HRD forum as well, but I think it's fair to say from this conversation that there's a lot going on in the current environment that means that there's a very complex mix for leaders to manage. So there's deeper uncertainty. I mean, you mentioned earlier about volatility, ambiguity. I think leaders have underestimated how much global leadership challenges around organization restructure, inflation, interest rate rises, and supply chain disruption have really amplified. Now, I think that said, regional leaders have benefited from greater decentralization over the past 18 months or so, and they have seen an empowerment. But the shift, I think, into local within global MNCs, it has created a real need to invest in middle management. And as I mentioned, the mindset shift required as you step up into new and expanded roles, I think, can very easily be underestimated. So, Wesley, I'm really keen just to hear a bit more about your take on this topic. And perhaps if we also pick up on the theme of global leaders as well, because I know that's something that's been thrown about quite a lot over the past 2 years or so.
Yeah, look, well, a couple of things. I think one is that organizations, as they expand, that means that the local or regional offices become have far greater importance. And as you talked about decentralization, which means they have greater responsibility for performing at that regional or local level, which means they have to have a greater understanding of their market, their industry, the company, competitors, both, you know, current and direct and indirect and incoming. And so I think it's really important to be able to understand and analyze what's taking place at a political level, at an environmental level, social, technological, legal, all at the same time. And it's almost as if you're your own business, and therefore you can't necessarily rely on the global headquarters to provide you information. You need to understand that in the context of really having a keen understanding of what's taking place at the local level, so that in effect, you're informing a global headquarters about what's happening on the local level, and they can actually inform you on a global stage what's taking place as the business sits in a global, you know, environment. So you have to be able to manage both, but the main thing is to understand the importance of your role, almost like a business unto itself. And so it's less about, you know, kind of a small bird waiting to be fed by its mother. You actually need to be able to go and feed yourself. And from that context, I think it allows you to have a greater understanding and a greater influence as to what's taking place at the local level.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that analogy of the bird feeding its mother. I think that's one piece of advice then for all of those listening in as well. So building on that a bit more then, Wesley, what impact would you say that the potential shift in skills needed is having on succession planning across the region?
Yeah, look, sometimes it's difficult. I looked after Fonterra's talent and organization developments, and, you know, had 4,000 people that I was looking after across four different businesses in Australia and New Zealand. And so in the context of looking at succession planning, it was an ability to understand and recognize who was available. And I actually developed an initiative called Available to Offer, which is actually looking at people who had been in roles, performed very high, had high potential, but also been in their role for 2 years or two business cycles. But the idea was to let's, as a culture, start to move people around. So I've created this thing called Build by Move, which is around building internal capability and a leadership pipeline, bringing in great talent, but at a much smaller level. So about a ratio of 20% new and 80% homegrown leaders to provide a way to focus on this notion of healthy churn. But the most important piece of that was this idea of moving people around the business. So they didn't necessarily get promoted, but what they did do was they were involved in secondments or specific development focused projects or specific change projects. But the idea was to put them in different places where they could learn. So we moved, for example, a CFO from New Zealand to China to give this individual greater exposure and to develop some specific capabilities. But then that person came back and was able to take a senior role as opposed to a smaller role that he initiated from. So, you know, whether it be an international assignment, whatever, but the idea is to move people around within the business. So it may be a lateral move, but because you've gained specific experience, it allows you to move into a succession pipeline where now we can see the value of the experience that you've developed, and we can apply that in different parts of the business. But the last thing I'll say, which I think was probably the most important, was to put as a part of people's performance review this idea of having to identify talent that's not in your patch and to be able to promote them into another part of the business. So if you can imagine me as a managing director of a business unit, I was tasked with identifying talent from outside of my business, developing them, and ensuring that they were promoted into another business. So now you've made it part of my performance to develop people all around me that aren't necessarily in my patch, in my business. And other people were doing the same. So they were kind of identifying talent within my business and helping them to develop and promoting them outside. So this kind of whirlwind of talent development was quite ingenious. because it allowed people to be involved all over the world, you know, through 17,500 people across about 150 countries. And that really changes the dynamics of developing people and allowing them to be known quantities across a large business and to be moved around in that way, which led to being put on a succession list.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Wesley. There's so many themes there that we could pick up on, and there's so many more questions that I could ask you, but let's just park that topic for a moment, because one theme that I am really keen for us to discuss is diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how leaders can lead the transformation of that. I know when we spoke prior to this, Wesley, you mentioned kind of three key areas in relation to this topic. Can you just build upon those for me?
Yeah, so I'm actually publishing an article called Transforming Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And the theme is around adoption, innovation, and disruption. So adoption is around putting in place processes that allow you to gather data, granular data, that talks about who's in the business so that you can start to identify diversity and then be able to be in a position to value its difference. So, you know, if someone said, you know, who's who, and you probably can talk about that on a very high level, but the more granularity you have, the more you have an opportunity to, again, value those differences and leverage those differences so that you're not just sitting here thinking, well, everybody went to an Ivy League school or everybody went to school full stop. We have some other types of experiences, whether it be education, orientation, nationality, all those types of things make for an opportunity to value difference. Innovation, we talk about auditing, policies, practices, structures, and systems, because those systems probably need to be deconstructed because they were probably built by people who had privilege. And so if we look at any system in our world, we can see, well, you know, this system was built by people who had certain levels of education or certain riches. And so those systems in which they built meant that only people like them were able to benefit in those systems. So in many ways, we need to deconstruct those, rebuild them so that there's an equitable system and everyone can create opportunities and innovation in that context. And then the last one is around disruption, which, you know, effectively means if we want to build an inclusive culture in which everyone can bring their whole selves to work, we probably need to create a culture that's discontinuous from the previous one. So we've created a new culture that allows people to identify what place they can have, value their contributions, and again, create something that probably is discontinuous from the previous culture. And so those three things, adoption, innovation, and disruption, are critical to transforming diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Okay, that's great. Thanks so much. And how do you think then organizations can hold themselves accountable to drive that transformation?
I think it, you know, comes back to outcomes, right? So we often, or previously we talked about employers of choice. So when we think about, you know, if we've actually created a diverse, equity and inclusive organization, we're likely to see lots of different types of people come through the door. You know, the old idea of IBM, all white males wearing blue suits, is gone. Mm-hmm. Now we want to see people walk through the door that have different life experiences, look different, love different, enjoy life differently. And so from my perspective, the way in which to hold organizations accountable is not only to see the people that walk in the door, but to see who leaves and look at how an organization is followed. Are they followed, like, in terms of the people that buy their services or enjoy whatever products they develop? Who are customers? And our customers will probably more than likely reflect who we are. So if we create something that is limited to a certain type of person, that's probably who's going to follow us. So again, back to this idea of outcome focused. We kind of become you know, who our customers say we are. And the more diversity of customers is likely to be reflected in who we are as a business and vice versa.
Okay, great. And how important then would you say that incentives and KPIs are in terms of driving the right behaviors in relation to this?
That's a really important component. I know I've developed KPIs for a lot of organizations, from HR to finance to development. But I think what's really important is that it all rolls up into a purpose. And so KPIs for KPIs' sake really don't hold water. It's being able to identify an organization purpose. And from that, what is going to allow you to get there at each level of the organization, whether that's the leadership team, CEO, managing director, and his or her team, down to their direct reports, down to the groups and teams that they lead. But being able to look at KPIs as a way to roll all of this up. So what we actually see is my plan for what I need to do to help facilitate the overall organization purpose and help to achieve that.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you, Wesley. So one final point of reflection then. What is one key piece of advice that you'd like to share, Wesley, for our audience listening in today?
Like, I think one of the things that I find really interesting about talent and leadership is the more we understand about the really core components of leadership or talent, the more we realize is that it's not these very specific skills, but these broader skills. If we look at a basketball team, and I'm going to assume you've seen a basketball game every now and again, but the idea is we kind of go, the role of a center, typically the tallest person on the team, is so that, you know, he or she can rebound, block shots, and all of that. What we've realized is that it depends. So if we're in an organization and I'm looking at what I need and what I need as a center, I'm going to look for the tallest person. But instead, I think what's more important for us to do is to look for the best player. And the best player will allow us to put those people in positions to block shots or make shots or rebound. But it's less about having very specific and narrowly defined skills, and far more important to just to get the best person available. And the best person available is more likely to be able to be taught specific roles, but because they're the best player, you've got the best player on the team. And that allows you to function in very different ways and strategies than if you only had a center who could only rebound and only block shots. But a better player or the best player could do far more things that are probably far more valuable than just one thing.
Absolutely. And great analogy there. I hope that everybody listening in is a fan of basketball.
I hope so too.
Look, Wesley, there's so many other things that we could pick up on. It's been such an interesting conversation, and it's so great to hear all of your wonderful insight from your perspective as well. But I think this is a good point after the reflection to draw the conversation to a close. But look, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Wesley. And thank you to our audience for listening in as well. And we'll see you very soon. Take care, Wesley.
Thanks, Ali.